Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it, put it on an iPod, iPad, and hit play. Today we have an interesting show after what's been a five-week hiatus from recording podcasts, spent partly in Europe, but largely in a work schedule, which has dramatically increased and unfortunately has made it harder for me to crank out these podcasts in the numbers I've been accustomed to doing. So this show focuses on a study released in April 2012 by the not-for-profit Rand Institute for Civil Justice on electronic discovery costs called Where the Money Goes, Understanding Litigant Expenditures for Producing Electronic Discovery. And it's been authored by Nicholas Pace with editorial assistance provided by Laura Zacharias. And frankly, I'm perplexed that more people aren't talking about this comprehensive study. Perhaps the conclusions of the study that the best solution for solving the high cost of document review is using more technology such as predictive coding has been muted a bit by the high-profile De Silva-Moore case in New York being overseen by Judge Peck, or the Virginia case, Global Aerospace, where the parties are using predictive coding and tackling some of the open issues discussed in the Rand report. I hope that isn't the case, because this 130-page study, I think, is a must-read for any lawyer or client who has any interest in proportionality and efficiency in the process of collecting, processing, and reviewing ESI. This piece was not a vendor propaganda piece. Rand has no skin in the game with coming up with their conclusions. I'm also going to borrow a phrase used in a Ralph Losey blog when he described Maura Grossman and Gordon Cormack's groundbreaking article on machine-assisted review or predictive coding. This is not an easy read. It's not a tweet or a blog. It's a collection of economic analysis and industry white papers, which happens when you lift up the rock on the process of e-discovery by analyzing 8 anonymous companies and over 50 cases they litigated over the past few years, ending in 2010, before predictive coding has become, out in the mainstream. So this does require, a little bit of thinking while you read it. It's not a quick one. But I highly recommend that others read it. And in fact, I've been involved in drafting an overview piece on predictive coding for the Seventh Circuit pilot program, and I kicked off the narrative by quoting the Rand study before even attempting to explain how predictive coding works or giving tips on how to use it in the meet and confer process. So now let me introduce our guest, Nicholas Pace, who authored this piece and is a social scientist at the Rand Corporation. Nick has contributed his expertise in civil justice-related research methodology to many projects for the Rand Institute for Civil Justice, including a study that he led that explored issues associated with class actions against insurers. Other recent work includes examining the impact of a statutory reforms on costs and outcomes of medical malpractice cases, and leading a comprehensive study of the workers' compensation courts in California. He's also been involved in studying the dynamics of class action litigation generally and recommending new managerial approaches for judges in such cases, helping to accomplish an in-depth evaluation of the Civil Justice Reform Act of 1990 and its effects on judicial case management costs and delay in federal district courts, analyzing jury verdict outcomes with a special focus on punitive damage awards, and developing national standards related to the electronic filing of pleadings and other legal documents in civil courts. He's leading the ICJ's research agenda in civil jury verdicts, conducting a study of post-trial adjustments to jury awards, looking at the impact of Class Action Fairness Act of 2005, and investigating how state court judges handle scientific and other complex evidence issues. Nick also received his JD from the University of Oregon. And Nick, very impressive background. If anything ever happens to me, you can take over ESI Bytes. I think you've got the best background for it of anyone I've ever encountered. So glad to have you on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So first of all, why don't we start with a slightly different approach to starting? Why don't you tell us a little bit about the Rand organization?
Well, the Rand Corporation has been around since the end of World War II, and it's a nonprofit, independent public policy research organization. It was started by the Air Force when they saw the war winding down and realized the older mad scientists were going to go back to the universities, the ones that they had collected during the war. So they wanted to have a place where they could bounce off crazy ideas and to create what is now called a think tank. And so for a long time, RAND's work was national security based. It did a whole bunch of Dr. Strangelove kind of stuff, ranging from coming up with a way to get messages from Washington and New York if the Ruskies had taken out Topeka, and that led to the development of packet switching and ultimately email, looking at the development of the Strategic Air Command and the like. But starting in the 60s or so, we started doing what we called domestic research, looking at issues related to, say, health and education and immigration. One of the natural areas of interest to policymakers in this country is it relates to how the courts and the justice system works. And in the late 70s, we created the Institute for Civil Justice, which looks at, it tries to provide empirical research to policymakers such as judges and legislatures and to to the members of the legal community such as litigants and lawyers to sort of bring some sort of way to make the system more equitable and more efficient.
Okay, those are all good goals. Well, let's talk about eDiscovery now. How did you get interested in eDiscovery as a topic to focus on?
Well, some of the early work that RAND had done was some of the first empirical work into looking at the cost of litigation back in the late 80s and 90s, a natural area of interest to anyone looking at the legal system in general. And we went out and collected information about how much money was being spent by for legal fees and particular types of cases and the like. And with the increasing attention from the legal community on electronic discovery around the turn of this past century, it's hard, still hard for me to say those words, but around 2000.
We're all getting older.
Yeah. I'm not getting older. The world's getting older. People kept saying, hey, why don't you did this work earlier. This is what you really ought to be looking at now. The world has changed, and why don't you go out and do a study on electronic discovery and pretrial litigation costs and see how they compare. And we thought about this. Certainly this is a topic that is high on the radar screen of both people here at RAND, but also the people that are some of our funders and the like. And so we looked at this study and at the area, and we thought, oh, this is deserving. But one thing that was clear to us is that we didn't want to write a report that simply compared the cost of litigation under a paper world with that of under electronic world and come up with the conclusion, gee, it's a lot more expensive, because nobody in this debate, including the most rabid critics of current pretrial litigation costs, argue for return to paper-based record keeping. That horse has left the barn, if you will. And we didn't want to do a study that was just going to find a whole bunch of really expensive cases and scream loudly how, it's costing many, 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 many millions of dollars to litigate a case. It may well be that money is very reasonable compared to the stakes that's involved. So we wanted to take a look at this from a different standpoint and try to figure out, okay, if electronic discovery costs are a pain point for many litigants, so what aspect of that seems to be driving the costs?
Okay, so let's talk about how you started the study. When did you start it? How did you approach it?
Well, we went through a couple of iterations in trying to get started. We wanted, let's figure out how much money is being spent. And one of the first ways that we thought about it was doing, the typical RAND study is to do this giant broadcast survey to folks. And we realized pretty quickly that no one was going to disclose their litigation costs in an anonymous survey. And we wound up going with a case study approach, focusing in on 8 very, very large corporations and trying to get a sense of what happened in actual cases that they were litigants, both as defendants but also as plaintiffs, and always they were the responding party in a demand for production of electronically stored information. And
Was there any magic to the number 8, or did you just at that point get tired of asking people and say, we have enough?
I think you've hit the... I'm
in that same position myself with something I'm working on, but go ahead. I was at 12, and now I'm like, okay, 8 might be enough. If Rand can get 8, I'm going to aim for 8, but go ahead.
I hate to demystify the research process, but that's just about what it came down to. Maybe we can talk about a little bit later what the difficulties are in this type of research, but... we seemed, you know, what we were getting here at 8 with the, we collected some financial information for 8 cases where there was an ESI production, and the numbers, you know, from a variety kinds of cases and a variety of kinds of companies and a variety of types of in terms of the scale, they were coming out to be about, you know, pretty consistent. Not consistent, I shouldn't just say that, but the numbers sort of aligned in very similar ways. And at that point, we said, well, look, we're a limited budget organization. We have limited resources, and at some point, we have to sort of pull the plug on it. So that's where the 8 comes from.
Okay. Well, what was the hardest aspect about the study?
Well, we were keep in mind that we were asking these folks to describe to us in great detail about the expenditures that were made in specific cases that had mostly had concluded, or a couple were still in progress, but the electronic discovery production had been completed, and that's a problematic area of research for a couple reasons. One is companies, litigants, really don't think along the lines of tracking information that tracking costs and expenditures to a point, to a granulated level, fine enough as to a specific discovery event, right? And that's just true. I mean, the traditional model of litigants years ago was to simply pay their outside counsel to do everything, and their major responsibility was to make sure they paid the invoice on time, and that's changed over time with litigants taking a greater level of control of their, for example, in e-discovery, they're the ones that are going out often and collecting data from their individual servers. They're the ones that are doing some of the processing and sometimes doing a little bit of the review. So trying to get them to tell us to think back and to figure out exactly what was spent in a specific case that happened 2 years ago is difficult enough. The other major problem is that this information is stuff that is highly considered to be highly sensitive and potentially damaging. And one can argue that their concerns are misplaced or maybe a little overemphasized, if you will. But I'll give you an analogy. For one, I said, you know, why are you so concerned about? I said to this one person, why did you be so concerned about telling me about what you spent on this case? You know, the case is over, you know. He said, well, look, in poker, when you fold your cards, you slide your cards into the pile face down so no one can see exactly what you had in your hand when you folded. Well, in litigation, you're folding all the time, except for the 5% of cases that go to trial and maybe the 10 or 15 that wind up getting knocked out in a summary judgment. Everything else is a settlement. Essentially, you're folding. You're either taking less than you think you ought to have gotten, or you're paying more than you think you should. And so, if you tell the other side what your litigation expenses were, you get essentially a roadmap to understanding what numbers were high enough to drive someone to make that decision. Also, when you talk about one of the other aspects we were looking at is asking them to tell us all about their, their information technology systems. You know, where do they store data? How do they keep it? How do they handle archiving? Where do the emails go and everything else? And the argument there was, look, you're giving, again, the roadmap. You're giving, if I were to release that information to the outside, If somebody ever found out about this, they could be they any every time they sue us, they could craft a discovery request, a production request that would essentially be a nightmare in terms of costs. And sure, maybe we can go to the judge and argue proportionality, but maybe the judge won't buy into it, and we'll wind up essentially having to settle the case or wind up spending a whole lot of money on discovery. So,
I hear these objections, too, with some of the open networking groups that we do, this Friends of eDiscovery group that I run in Pittsburgh. And, you know, the reaction I have when companies say things like that, when we propose topics, is, do you really think you're doing something all that different from everyone else? The EDRM model is out there, which everyone has grabbed and built processes around, and people are tweaking in different areas, but the field has pretty much moved with similar approaches, even if they're a little bit different, you know, on hourly rates or types of people.
Right.
By and large, the tools are pretty similar up until, you know, what we're talking about now.
Sure.
With sort of a significant change, a paradigm shift almost. But looking backwards, I have yet to run into anyone that surprised me what they've been doing.
And I think that battle-hardened litigators have a pretty darn good idea of what it's costing the other side to do any particular thing. They often work both sides of the fence. They're both, especially in commercial litigation, you're both plaintiffs and defendants, you're both responding parties, you're both producing parties.
Mm-hmm.
You've handled the litigation for corporations of relatively similar size and industry and information technology systems, and so you know those folks already know what it costs, what a particular demand is going to cost. So I agree. I think that some of the concerns were voiced to us were not well founded, which was one of the reasons why it was so difficult to get this mm-hmm. project going, because I was always amazed by people, large scale corporate litigants, who are very vocal in the policy debate about their concerns about the high cost of discovery. And, we're always, clapping me on the back every time I talked about it. And then when I asked them to, drop their trousers, if you will, and show me what they got.
Yeah.
It was at that point they go, oh, well, that's a different story. I'm a little,
It's the only way to move the ball forward is to actually show examples. And, I was pleased with, the Microsoft letter that came out, and that's part of the debate on over-collecting, where they went through some of their metrics for all the cases that they're not even involved in, but they have to collect and preserve, and the staggering costs there. I mean, I think we need more of that. So, that's why I think your report is a must-read for anyone that's interested in trying to figure out what makes sense.
And, well, and to do what we did, I'm not sure it was necessary in every instance, but we had to assure folks of confidentiality in terms of the participant names, but also about the particular case and about people's names and the subject matter and the like. And but despite that, you have to give kudos to these companies for taking that step, and that's true for everything about civil justice research. When you talk about empirical research, you're talking about somebody revealing something to an independent researcher like myself, and unless the folks take that step, we still work on anecdote and rumor.
Yep.
And that's not the way the system ought to be working.
I agree. So let's look at some of the economic analysis that came out of it. Some of the median numbers that jumped out to me, and there were a lot of numbers, lawyers represent 70 cents of every dollar spent. Review is 73 cents out of every dollar. And again, there were highs and lows in these charts. But there seemed to be wide acceptance that review is where the focus needs to be. But people had different strategies that were all over the place.
Well, that's this was kind of interesting to us that that in fact they did have different approaches. You know, some of these folks used you know, in-house. I mean, they used you know, sort of the traditional associates from their outside counsel. Other ones were having vendors ship stuff off to, I believe, the Philippines. You know, are doing mixes of the two, and there are a lot of models there. I think there was a couple where they used contract attorneys in-house. You know, so it's a wide variety. But at the end of the day, look, whether, you know, we came to the conclusion that in the cases that we looked at, and these are large, I want to keep in mind, these are large-scale document productions. These are not, you know, one banker box full of documents. That ultimately it looked like about 8% of the money that was being spent by these litigants was for collection, gathering this in the potential, these sources and locating them of ESI and getting them in one spot. About 19% dealt with processing, you know, like reducing the volume of the collected documents, modifying them to make them more suitable for review or whatever else. But the 73% of the money that was being spent was being spent for review. You know, that, you know, this is no secret to litigants and their lawyers. I mean, I think, but I'm not sure anyone had gone out and tried to you know, quantify it like we had. And we also try to look at this from a different way. Okay, let's, rather than the task, look at the source. Who's doing this? And we tried to do our best job we could to sort of truly zero in on internal expenditures. When I say litigants, you know, for example, what does it cost to have two people from the IT department going around and making mirrored copies off of hard drives? You know, what does it cost to have in-house counsel oversee the management of a document production and make decisions and the like? And we try to do a very good, we discuss and report some of the techniques we use to expand that out. But in the end of the day, we could, on these big, large-scale document productions, it was about just 4% of the money being spent was being spent by the litigants themselves on internal, you know, resources, including people. About 26% were vendors, and they could do a lot of different things, from collection to processing, in some sense, in some instances, review. But the largest amount of money, about 70%, was probably not unexpectedly for their outside counsel.
You know, I have an anecdotal story on this. I present every so often to American Corporate Counsel Association, and they do lunch CLEs here in the Western District of Pennsylvania. And 3 years ago, I presented on the number one topic they survey every year. What do you want to talk about, in-house lawyers? And number one was managing outside counsel, which I've never done before. I've been a consultant. I've been in staffing. You know, although I'm an attorney, I've never managed outside counsel, okay? But it's what they wanted to hear. So I figured no lawyer is going to step up there and you throw this one out there. So I studied it like an MBA student. I put together some proposals on different techniques that were out there, and we had a really great roundtable discussion. It was a very effective presentation, okay? At the end of the survey, the last rated topic was e-discovery, okay?
Interesting.
So 3 years or 2 years later, I went back, and I presented on e-discovery and predictive coding. But I said, I want to turn your study around and say, you should be managing outside counsel in e-discovery. And you shouldn't look at this as being something that's, you know, if you're so interested in managing outside counsel, why are you so uninterested in e-discovery? And your study drives it home. You got to, because this is where a lot of the costs are.
Well, you know.
But your 4% number is really interesting.
I mean, you think that they're what's interesting is what you describe there is that evolving perception, and I think it mirrors something that that I think is very telling about the e-discovery debate. Because if we were having this conversation, say 12 years ago, and we were talking about this new thing called electronic discovery. What are the problems? There would be costs, right? We'd be talking about costs. But what we would be focusing in on our collection. We would have been talking about, boy, this is, you know these problems we're having on trying to get access to, trying to find certain files and emails on backup systems, on disaster recovery systems, pulling data from legacy computer systems. We've bought another company. They've got, older machines we don't really run anymore. Finding somebody, some old professor that can still write in Fortran to pull the data off. All this stuff helped drive the debate. And we started making rules about things like whether something was reasonably accessible. That's all mm-hmm. about collection. This is what people focused on at the beginning of this thing. And so the outside council wasn't even on the radar screen. It was all about this technological issue about trying to pull data off of particular platforms and servers and everything else. Since then, I think this is a technological problem, and it's been addressed through technology. You've had developers say, I could have made that backup system pull off individual records if you'd like. You just never told me this was important. So you see the developers are addressing it, and by 2012, the issue of the collection isn't that big of a deal anymore. I mean, I don't mean to minimize it. 8% of $100 million is still a lot of money, but the collection has become an increasingly smaller issue increasingly smaller pain point, if you will, for litigants. And I think that's true for processing as well. Again, technological issue, coming up with all kinds of new novel approaches for things looking at near duplicates, clustering email conversations, whatever else. That kind of stuff is becoming, getting the full weight and attention of the computing industry. And I think over time that's shrunk. And so what's left is this giant elephant in the room, which is still human eyes a review.
Yeah. So, let's go through these three buckets you identified in the study, collection, processing, and review. And first of all, why did you condense the buckets and not just use the EDRM model? I mean, you ended up on these three.
Well, I mean, the EDRM model does exactly what it's supposed to do, which is to give you a high-level, 40,000-foot overview of everything. Right,
mm-hmm.
And in some ways, if you want to think about it, it starts at the very the left side of the EDRM. Of course, if you talk to people that divide it, they go, "Oh no, it's not linear, it's not all this." But if you look at the left side of it, you're going to say, it almost starts with the day that a company decides, okay, throw away those IBM Selectrics, and when we keep typing up memos on piece of paper and put it in our office mail, let's get some of those newfangled computers and start sending emails to each other about new products and business decisions. And, so you're starting at this sort of basic left side part of the EDRM, and it goes all the way to the point at which an attorney is in a courtroom holding a wireless mouse and clicking on a PowerPoint presentation showing the data to a jury. That's a huge swath of time, money, concepts, and everything else. And so we wanted to focus in on what seemed to be the key problem for folks in terms of what people think about traditionally as electronic discovery, which is production, document production. Now,
okay.
The EDRM does use the word production in a slightly different way, but we use this term to mean the steps from collection to processing review. It's not a standalone part, and especially in terms of preservation, which has an overarching influence over all those steps. But I think that's what people talk about, and I think it was the best way. To get a handle on expenditures.
No, I agree, and these are the litigation pain points. So let's dive into each of the three, and you were talking a little bit about both of them, so you may repeat a little bit or you may add some flavor, but, what was your analysis in collection? I mean, you spotted some interesting trends and some issues there.
Well, I mean, you have the numbers there, but I think what was interesting is sort of the conversations we had with these folks who were you know, sort of at the, these were experienced litigants. These were not first timers. They had been doing electronic discovery in some form for quite some time. And they were highly, I would say, in tune with the e-discovery community. Again, you're not talking about neophytes that knew nothing about it. And you know, often you'll see things in blogs about attorneys that don't know anything or judges. This is not the case here. These are experienced litigators who know this world. And you get some of the sense from them that they were, you know, trying to thinking about the collection phase as something that they could control better.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a lot of interest in trying to bring stuff in house. This was sort of a common theme we heard. Where, you know, we can do a lot of this stuff. We don't need to be paying vendors to go pull data off of our own machines. Buying, they talking about buying cross-platform collection tools so that they could be in control of pushing the button to pull data off of people's laptops and you know, tablets and servers and everything else. And I think there was also an issue about information security. You know, that they would rather have control over their data before and decide what they're going to turn over to outside vendors and outside counsel. So, I mean, there seems to be a sense that we could do more things along this line and let's figure out what they are. And but really, in the end of the day, you're talking about shifting some part of that 8% to the company,
mm-hmm.
right? And so you can, you know, say you essentially, you know, you cut your collection costs in half by doing it in-house. You buy the $1 million collection tool. You no longer have to pay a vendor for it and everything else. What have you done? You've dropped that 8% to 4%. No, I'm not trivializing that, but is it really going to make a huge, big difference in terms of your overall e-discovery expenditures?
Yeah, probably. CFOs love ROI, and your ROI, you didn't really stop the bleeding. You put a Band-Aid on, you needed a tourniquet. We'll get to the tourniquet in a minute.
But, you know, if they only focus on the collection, which is a lot of what they, you know, they seem to think about, you know, it looks like a great deal. It looks like a wonderful, you know, steps.
Yep. And yeah, absolutely. And there are lots of good reasons to do it for information governance or frankly, if you want to lump collection into getting rid of data too at the same time, that might hit your ROI.
Right.
You know, data remediation. But that's a whole separate topic. But I think it fits in the same framework of understanding your data. Processing the next stage, you know, that's 19% of the costs. You know, didn't see, you know, I don't recall a lot jumping out at me from this space, but maybe you want to throw what you recall, and then we'll hit the tourniquet.
Well, this is definitely a vendor area. I mean, the collection was being done, you know, a lot of it was being done, some fraction of it being done by in-house, but this is a vendor-controlled area. And that was kind of interesting to me because some of the companies that we were talking to are, I mean, I don't know how to put it, you know, without revealing who they are, but I mean, you know, if you can think of highly sophisticated vendors, proprietors of information technology, they would be in that category, and yet they, I think none of the companies that we were dealing with, you know, did processing, had the majority share of the money that they spent for processing was done by themselves. They almost always used vendors.
The analogy I've heard is, why does IBM buy Salesforce.com? If they do, okay?
Yeah, okay.
I don't know if they do. The price point's right. They can use their resources in better areas.
And, you know, there's development going on all the time to be, you know, it's not just a matter of building a good box. It's keeping that box up to date. And why not just let somebody else do it? I think that's what they come down to being.
Okay. So let's hit the review area, which we'll sort of focus on here for the rest of this, I'm sure. You know, what jumped out of you in that space?
Well, I mean, look, I mean the jump out, if you look at the chart, is, you know, it's 3/4 of that chart is review of the whole whole amount of money, and that includes a lot of different kinds of approaches that are being done by companies. I mean, you know, it wasn't all just sending it out to some gray-haired senior counsel charging $600 an hour. It was, you know, using contract attorneys. It was using low-paid associates. It was using offshore vendors for legal process outsourcing. So the one thing that we didn't see a lot of was really bringing the stuff in-house, meaning we didn't see a lot of ones where they were assembling their own teams of reviewers. Now, that doesn't say that they weren't doing review in-house to some component of it, but they might, for example, have shipped the majority of it off to India, and then the documents that have been flagged as relevant come back, and they might spend some time looking at them using their own in-house counsel. But generally they're not really doing the lion's share in-house.
If they want to reduce the price of a law firm, they're outsourcing to a lower cost provider,
right?
But they're not doing it themselves.
Exactly. They're taking control over it, but not necessarily doing it. And it seemed to me that this was a model that was going to be exploited more and more in the future, that they were saying to us. Let me just say that as time has evolved, you know, there has been this sort of shakeup in the legal world, and it seems, and this is, you know, purely impressionistic, that outside counsel firms are a lot more amenable to coming up with alternative strategies for handling litigation expenses, and one of them may be a lot more willingness to shop around for vendors to handle some of the legal the review process of it. So things may well be different in 2010 than 2012 than they were probably in 2009 and or so when we were collecting these numbers. But generally, these companies at the time that we were looking at it, you know, were trying to control it but not necessarily doing it themselves.
So you've got 73 cents out of every dollar as a median number, and the approaches that were being used were not. You didn't have anyone using a predictive coding or machine-assisted review approach, but you had the full, other types of options that seem to have been out there now with different forms of labor costs, right?
Oh, that's correct. They were doing a lot of different things. The one thing they weren't doing is eliminating the process of somebody, whether it's in India or the penthouse suite in Manhattan. Somebody was looking at each individual document before sending it out the door.
Now, you know, were the companies surprised to see it was so high, or do they really understand this is where the bleeding's happening?
I think the ones that are, I think it's sort of, If you're going to ask me that, I think it was like, well, yeah, I guess that's right. But it was sort of like a given that some of them that when you talk about e-discovery, the sexy e-part of it is the collection and processing. And so there was a lot of focus on what they were doing there and maybe a little less focus on what the review side of it, because it was just, they're doing it the way they were doing it 20 years ago, and known that this was an issue, it probably wasn't, it hadn't risen to a source of concern. I've certainly heard people complaining about a review, outside counsel for review costs. I remember one guy saying, you know, it's like they every time we have a discovery production demand, it's like a bird nest on the ground to these guys. You know, they look at it, they start salivating, and we really have to, you know, throttle them back to stop them from, you know, spending a lot of money. I mean, this is, I don't want to paint a negative picture of outside counsel, but you know, there's certainly concerns along those lines.
Well, what you're saying rings true with what I was saying back when I was focused on staffing linear reviews. I couldn't get on panels beyond 4 o'clock on a Friday, even if I threw $10,000 sponsorship fees. It wasn't, you know, that was our slot. And I kept saying, but I think this is where the money's being spent, and it just didn't matter. Now, you know, hey, I was just in Chicago last week participating in the Seventh Circuit program entirely on predictive coding and review, and we were the main act, and that felt good. But
I mean, what I believe is that they never really considered review to be a cost that could be addressed in the past. I remember asking a very famous jurist at a conference in Chicago on electronic discovery who were talking about the cost of discovery and talking about proportionality. And I said, well, are you including review in there? You know, so if you're talking about, is this the cost of discovery production, you know, proportional to the stakes of the case? And this woman said, you know, I hadn't really thought about it. You know, I imagine that's not true today, but at least a number of years ago, people really didn't think about review as being something that could be addressed through rules or, you know, or through technological means or whether it should be part of the calculus of deciding whether a discovery request is onerous or not. I was going to say that. And the funny thing is as these review costs, I mean, as the collection costs and the processing costs become, I think, increasingly smaller, you have this other side of the equation where organizations are, as everyone is well aware of, organizations are maintaining larger and larger stores of information for their routine business uses. I mean, and there's really no limit. I mean, I remember a few years ago at RAND, we had a big warehouse down the street, and we could only stuff so many boxes into this giant warehouse. It was a big warehouse, but at some point there was no more room to go in there. Well, you can go to Best Buy, buy a terabyte drive for $350 now. I don't mean to minimize the cost of what a drive cost, an enterprise class drive, and people, the electricity to run it, and the cooling that's needed, and blah, blah, blah. But the cost of storage is so small, and the applications that are coming out are just like almost every day. The amount of information that companies are going to store over the, you know, is going to continue to increase, and much of that information is going to be plainly discoverable. And so you've got this smaller and smaller collection and processing component, more and more information that's being stored, and therefore at the end of the day, this review burden is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
So you came up with a suggested solution in here after running through all the different options, and you came out without, you know, really having any case studies to show, but just this thought that, you know, we can't do it any of the tried and true ways, but it's got to be technology-assisted review, and we need to develop this area. And you want to go through sort of your analysis on this?
Well, I mean, you know, so we clearly the big giant sore spot was review, and so what do you do about it? Okay, well, one thing you can do is you can make it cheaper by paying lawyers less, and you know, is that doable? Well, not really. I mean, you know, certainly there's a market for lawyers that need review work. I just saw that half of the new graduates from law schools don't get a permanent job within their first year nowadays. So you've got this big, you know, pool of barred counsel that, you know, are looking for work. But, you know, there's just so much, you know, you can only pay them, you can only slash their wages so much. They're coming out of law school with $100,000, $200,000 worth of debt. They can't work for $8 an hour and pay that debt off, right? So, you know, you see in North Dakota they're paying $10 to $15 for bar counsel. Even in New York, they might be paying $25 or $35. Sounds like a lot of money, except they're living in Manhattan. So there's just no way that they can get this down much further. Shipping it off to the Philippines or India or Argentina or even China, you know, sure, you're going to get really, really inexpensive attorneys there, but, you know, there are issues about sending, you know, intellectual property and everything else to a country that may not have the same rules for protecting ethical obligations and the like. So the other thing is, can you make them work faster?
And they may not have the cultural sense of what the real impact of the language is if it's a second language.
Yeah, so you see something like, you know, we really hit it out of the park on this one. I'm glad you hit the nail on the head. we really knocked him out in the third round. Okay, well, that you know, we can look at that and we think, oh, geez, maybe this is a hot doc and we need to flag it. Somebody in Canton, a province, probably looks at it and says, well, geez, they must be talking about baseball or boxing or something. You know, so there's some cultural issues there. I don't want to denigrate the quality of those attorneys because they're doing nothing but review, you know, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. I have a feeling that they're very good at what they're doing, but there are issues involved in sending stuff, you know, to giant warehouses full of foreign attorneys.
Yeah. The only thing I have against this, and I think at anything, you should always look at doing economic analysis and figure these things out. But just the whole review space to try to cull data down per document price is built to eliminate data. You're not really adding value to the case. You are paid per document, which is what a lot of these people do, to be a filter.
Right.
And to me, that doesn't mean you're using your legal background. You're not paid to find stuff, which is sort of weird to me in a litigation sense.
Well, but. I mean, the problem is that the model, it's a very good model for small cases, is some attorney, hopefully with a little gray hair, a lot of experience, who is in control of the case, that looks through three banker boxes worth of documents, reads every one of them top to bottom, makes a very deliberate decision on relevance and responsiveness, looks for privileged information, looks for work product, looks for sensitive stuff, looks for potential trade secrets and like, and makes the same sorts of decisions, however he or she defines them, on every document. That's the perfect model. That works really great. That model, and that's the model that most litigants have been thinking about for, you know, what, a century or so. That model breaks down when you stop being one lawyer and two banker boxes of documents, and you start talking about 300 lawyers and a terabyte of information. And so you start getting into problems with inconsistency in decision making, and the like. And so this sort of we're getting to the point where we're asking these people to make the similar sorts of decisions on the same set of documents. That seems to be breaking down at the highest, you know, at the macro level, and yet we think, oh, gee, that's the gold standard. That's wonderful stuff. We had 300 lawyers look at these documents. Well, they looked at each one looked at 1/300th of the document set, and so there are problems with inconsistency.
And then there's the speed of review issue, the capacity people can look at.
You know, at the highest numbers you see something like 100 docs an hour, right? Well, this is a really great review firm that can do 100 docs an hour. Well, that's 36 seconds a document. Now, a speed reader at 1,000 words a minute, that's about 600 words. That's basically just a little over a page. So, you know, it's not realistic to assume that that's going to get better, right? So you can't make them work faster. You can't make them work much cheaper. What are you going to do? Well, you can't make humans go any faster, and you can't pay them less. So what else, you know?
It's technology, yeah.
Technology.
So, and you came up with some pretty dramatic, pencil on envelope type calculations that to make this palatable, we had to knock this down by 75%.
Let me give you background on that. You know, the problem is that, you know, there people talk about savings for a particular approach. We can knock 20% off here. We can knock 10%. And that's a lot of money. Okay. But when you want to figure out is there a magic number at which we stop talking about e-discovery costs and start talking about something else in the system, the high cost of service of process, I don't know, something else. And it seemed to me that, look, nobody's complaining about collection, really. I mean, they're not complaining about processing. And processing, what I think was about 19%. So if you could get review down to the processing side, if you could get review costs down to about what they are for processing, well, maybe people would stop complaining so much about electronic discovery. And that would require a 75% reduction in the current costs of this sort of human eyeball on document after document after document linear review. And so it seemed like a good target. So unless something we could see would get you 50 75% reduction, it really was good, but not necessarily a sea change in the economics of pretrial litigation.
Hey, I just want to add, I've been working with predictive coding for the last couple of years, but I've worked with an attorney developing models on doing this. And if you do a 90% cull rate with some of the assumptions we built in, we were able to get it down to 76.4% reduction with predictive coding approach, where processing is 55 cents on the dollar of what you're spending, and review comes down to 23 cents on the dollar. I mean, this can be done. These tools are here.
What was interesting when we were doing it is that I wasn't finding a lot of information about those kinds of numbers. In fact, that was what's striking me. I mean, what we were having to look at was these sort of experiments done at Trek and another sort of semantic analysis and information retrieval conferences and like these done by the people at universities looking at stuff. But getting hard numbers on what any sort of, what for lack of a better term, technologically assisted review can do was very difficult. And part of it, I think, is the fact that vendors are still trying to figure out, how should we price this? How should we do this? But the other big issue was that there weren't a lot of real-life examples being publicized. One of the things that became very clear to us in other discussions we were having during this study, well, we talked to people, not the ones that we were collecting data from, but from other in-house counsel and general counsel, and also for major litigators, was they would admit, yes, we are using predictive coding or some sort of semantic analysis technique. We're not telling anybody that we're using it. Nobody's asked us, so don't ask, don't tell. But you guys are doing a great job, so keep going. And, hopefully become in the mainstream. But
I got to tell you, the only way you get that number down for my analysis is to get rid of data that you're not going to really look at, and and it's not prioritizing review.
Well, I mean,
it's actually using it as a culling tool.
I mean, that's exactly what I mean. And let me just say about the term predictive coding, how we used it in the document. We use it in the same way one uses the terms Band-Aid or Kleenex or Lifesaver.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of a generic sense that, sort of a stand-in for any sort of machine learning semantic analysis where they had sort of iterative process. And I think your readers, rather than go over what predictive coding is here, I think your readers are probably familiar with it. I mean, your listeners. But
mm-hmm.
But so we use that term. I know that there's one company that is trying to trademark it. There's other companies that use slightly different terminology. I actually at one point in my document had it. I never used the word predictive coding. I used the term computer categorized document review. And my partner Laura Zakaris, who's a very good communication person, said that she would throttle me if I insisted on using this very cumbersome term.
Yeah.
So we sort of latched on to predictive coding because you could see in the literature this has been used again and again and again, but I'm using it in sort of a generic sense.
Yeah, here. Yeah, no one's getting sued for using that word,
okay.
Phrase, okay?
That was
so, there are now three cases out there where technology-assisted reviews being debated, used, or ordered. De Silva, More Clean Products, and Global Aerospace.
Right.
Is the RAND study still topical?
I think so. I think the three cases you mentioned, we had written a report last year, but, it takes a while to go through quality assurance and everything else. And so as after the turn of the year, I'm starting to look at these cases. They're just beginning to, have the first little rumbles out there, especially De Silva Moore. But I think we said in the document, and I think it still holds true today as of June 21st, 2012, that all three of those cases really don't do what we had hoped, have not yet done what we were hoping for, is this spark, a spark where the litigant has used predictive coding, the producing party has used predictive coding as its primary tool handling review. And the other side has challenged it after the fact. And both sides start coming in with statistics on recall and precision and experts for and against. And we're talking about an actual document review where we have numbers about how well it worked. And then at that point, the judge makes the decision. I think that kind of event will be a precipitating event in terms of sort of getting people to say, okay, well, at least it's been truly approved in the heat of the fire here. The Civil War, they're still talking about which judge should be handling the case. We're not even nobody has done anything in a global aerospace. You know, that's another case where we're still at the point before all the work has been done. We haven't really had.
You're going to have to wait a couple months.
You're going to have to wait a couple months
to have it vetted through, and you know, I'm involved in that, so I won't say too much. But it will happen. The discussion will happen, and we'll see what happens.
And then in Clean Products in the Northern District of Illinois. I mean, really, we're talking about the demanding party asking, telling the producing party what to use, and we really aren't. You know, that's still the judge has gone back and said, okay, you guys have to go back and come up with a mutually agreeable plan. So I think in all three of those cases, we still haven't got that precipitating event. What has happened is that this has raised the level of attention to predictive coding and other sorts of ways of addressing it to a point where I didn't see before. If you look at the blog, I mean, you look at some of the legal newsletters, the first thing you see at the top is an ad for predictive coding. You never saw that 3 months ago. You know, these cases are at the forefront of it's like the headline. Whatever, you know, what's ever happening in the latest soap opera installation in De Silva Moore, it's the headline in the legal media. And I think that's good. I mean, I'd rather see this sort of, you know, let's get oiled up and go to the mat kind of thing where litigation, the legal system is about people, it's about disputes and people, judges reaching decisions after all the arguments have been put on the table and with experts and the like. And I don't think it's happened in any of these three cases yet.
So, in terms of where we're at now, next steps from getting technology-assisted review more accepted, it sounds like we just need to start using it more.
Well, I also think it's up to the vendors to quit being so coy, and because right now you look at some of the claims we made, it's like snake oil. I mean, I know why people are turned off about this because it just looks like. Ads to grow hair on bald men, and
the package deal,
performance enhancements, or something. To be graphic about it, but you know, and they're not talking about what it's going to cost me, right? It's almost impossible to get that number, to say, look, we're going to do this for, you give us a 500 megabytes of data or gigabytes of data, and we'll do predictive coding to the ninth iteration, we'll do this for this particular fee. When folks start having those sort of benchmarks to use when pricing it out, I think they're going to be a lot more less likely just to ship this thing off to their outside counsel.
That's where law hurts. It shoots itself in the foot every time. It's the same problem you had with getting data out of companies. It's a fragmented market with poor information sharing, and that feeds into selling at a higher price. But part of the problem also, and from someone that's talked to many of the vendors and sort of pitched the field at a macro level, is if there's 300 cases in the country using these tools, the prices have to stay high to keep these companies in business.
Right.
You know, once most cases are, I think you will see the floor drop rather quickly because we're just talking about software, and you want to talk about taking an axe to the cost structure. I mean, it's all there. We're just talking about software.
There's a lot of very, very talented developers out there that would leap at the chance to come up with these to apply the latest techniques here and,
yep.
and drive down the costs. And hopefully that's going to happen very
yep.
soon.
So that's really the end of our show here. I want to thank you, Nick, for joining
sure.
us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have speakers like you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. And I'd like to thank our sponsor, Jurinov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed the podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember out the show and website phonetically, as it sounds out, is Easy Bytes of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come back to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI Bytes you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.